All right, so hope you guys had a nice weekend. It's election day. Hope you can find a chance to get out and vote. So I sent out presentation group updates yesterday. I think there's one person that will as yet to be assigned to a group that I hope to hear from. What I'd like you to do now that you know who your groups are is to find some time to get together, think a little bit, I mean, maybe do a tiny bit of research, so figure out what you personally would sort of like to do with it, and then get together as a group and take a first crack at thinking what it is that you might want to do. Not in detail necessarily, but sort of globally. And then elect a spokesperson. This is irrelevant for the grade. It basically is just someone who will email me a point of contact so that I don't have to try to talk to everybody in every group and just get snowed with emails. So if there's one person who then can try to set up a meeting time with me, what I'd really like to do is to sit, hear what you're thinking about, tell you some gotchas, and maybe give you some ideas or references or things that might help with that particular topic. I might not have a lot to add. I might have a lot to add, depending on what the topic is. And I certainly can give you some things to watch out for. Okay, so that's sort of the deal. We have a test coming up that I forget exactly when it is, but it's like in a couple of weeks, week and a half, maybe a little over a week and a half, I forget. But I'll send you an email out about that soon. Anything going on with you? Do you want to bring up? It's cold outside, yeah. Last weekend or whatever, it was feeling like spring. I was in denial. Nature doesn't let you get away with that too much in Rochester. So, all right. Just a quick reminder that we've been talking about induction, and we're going to keep with that for a little while. Remember, induction is the fact that if you have a changing magnetic field in some region of space, you'll actually induce an EMF. And there's the trick to these problems is actually knowing the direction in which an EMF is induced. And it's always good to keep this in mind, that an induced current in a closed conducting loop will appear in such a way that it fights the change, it opposes the change that created it. Let's see if this is a little bit better. Okay. And last class, there were a couple of good questions that I didn't field really well at the time, so I wanted to go back and think about them a little bit. One is, what happens if you have a superconductor in a magnetic field? And the reason I didn't field it then is because I knew that there was more complex, that the simple answer that would just come into my mind needed more thought, and I needed to go remind myself of what it was. If you have a superconductor and you then put it in a changing magnetic field, all right, because it's a superconductor, you will induce currents on the surface of the superconductor, because the charges are free to move. And so these will be persistent currents, and they will move to such an extent that they actually will cancel out the field so that it cannot penetrate into that superconductor. So that's what happens if you're taking a superconductor and you're putting it into an established magnetic field. If you have a superconductor and you have it not superconducting, so you have it above the superconductor, typically what happens is they are superconducting below a critical temperature, is what you call it. And that critical temperature for high temperature superconductors is still extremely cold. It's above liquid nitrogen temperature. I think it's around 150 degrees Kelvin or something like that now. But if you have it not superconducting and you have it in a field so that the magnetic field lines are actually penetrating through the superconductor and the field is constant and you cool the superconductor down, when it goes superconducting, it will actually push the magnetic field flux lines outside of the superconductor. This is called the Meissner effect, and I can't even tell you exactly what it is, but it's not classical induction. Okay, so and some superconductors, they have different behaviors a little bit with magnetic fields, and they can get classified that way. So we'll let the superconducting group tell us all about it later in the semester. But so life with superconductors is a little bit more difficult, but in terms of the classical thing where you take a magnetic field and you take a superconductor and you try to put it into a magnetic field, it will induce a current, and that current will be persistent. The other question that came up was, if you have a loop moving in a magnetic field, what happens? Let's start with a case that's a little bit simpler. Let's imagine that you have just a wire moving in a magnetic field. God, sorry, bad day. Hello? Okay. All I wanted to do was to draw a wire moving in a magnetic field. Now, you can think of the wires being made up of charges. So as this thing cuts across the field lines, you can think of these charges as actually moving. So you can think of it as V cross B. So if you look at this and you do V cross B, you'll see that a positive charge that's in that conductor will be pushed upward, so you'll get an EMF across this wire, okay? Where you'll have positive charges here and negative charges here. So that will happen whether the field is changing or not. Look at what happens, though, if you think of it in this way for this loop, okay? For this loop, for this wire, nothing's really happening. And this wire, piece of the wire, nothing's really happening. But for this wire, you're going to have the same EMF that we just had. So you're going to have something that pushes current up this way, right? And now for this one, you're going to have V cross B. Same thing, it's going to be pushing this way. If you have nothing here to break the symmetry, you're going to have basically the same EMF going this way as you have that way, and you'll just get no current. All right, so nothing will happen with that. There's another case, which I think you have in your problem set for this week, where you have an axis and you have a conducting rod that's spinning in the field. And if you think about that, if you think about the tangential velocity of the so picture that you have some spinning rod in a field. Okay. At small radius, as you know, you're in the same amount of time. You have the same angular velocity, but your linear velocity is going to be much less because your circumference that you have to go around in the same time is very small compared to what happens here at the outer edge. So the linear velocity here is much smaller than there. But as this goes around, you're going to have basically a velocity crossed into B. So you're going to have an EMF induced between this point and down here. Because you're going to have more EMF up here than you do down here, in a sense. So you're going to end up, as this thing goes around, even though it goes around in a circle, you'll end up with an EMF-induced across this. And you can actually make a generator out of something like this. It's called a homopolar generator. And I think you'll get to calculate that in one of your problems. So thinking of a conducting loop is a really good idea, and it's a good mental picture to have, but it doesn't suit all instances where induction comes into play. And sometimes it's really good to fall back on just thinking about QV cross B through the problem. There are examples where these things get tied together a little bit. If you have a uniform magnetic field in this region and you have a bar that is moving with some velocity in this way, and the uniform magnetic field is going in, it will induce a current in such a way that it will create a field going the other way, right? And if you ask what is the force on this rod, you can actually think of that by the induced current, and then using I L cross B in order to evaluate the direction of the force. And you'll find that if this rod is moving in and reducing the magnetic flux in this region, you'll find that the force on this rod is going to be the other way, right? The force is going to have to fight the change that's creating it. So in order to think your way through these problems, very often you're actually having to combine your thinking about the direction of the induced current with Lenz's law and the changing magnetic flux, and then using I L cross B in order to figure out the direction of the force. Okay? Any questions on that stuff? All right, so a lot of this will be clear as you do problems. Last time, another thing that we did was we looked at what we call self-inductance and mutual inductance. And what really happens is that if you look at some loop of some conducting loop, the magnetic flux through that loop is proportional to the current in that loop itself. And that constant of proportionality, if it's the loop itself, you call the constant of self-inductance. And since the EMF induced in the loop goes as derivative of time with respect to that magnetic flux, then it becomes minus L dI over dt. And so we call L the inductance. This is the symbol it gets in a circuit. So here's an example of an LRC circuit that we'll be talking about in a little while. Then we call we have something called the constant of mutual inductance, which really is the same sort of thing, except we're now looking at the current induced in the other and a different loop due to the changing current in the first loop. And there will be a constant of proportionality, just like we have over here, except you're now talking about the flux through loop 2 due to the change in flux 1 in loop 1. Other than that, it's sort of the same thing. This constant, in this case, very often it's M, sometimes it's L. Generally, we generally call it L, but sometimes books will call this one M to sort of define the difference between self-inductance and mutual inductance. You really need to read the problems very carefully and not just go on whatever symbol they happen to use in the problem. So this basically quantifies the crosstalk between these two different loops, and this constitutes the loop talking to itself, basically. And it will be a geometric constant that tells you how much that is the case. If the loop is bigger or has more turns in it, it's going to have a greater constant of proportionality between the flux and its current, so it's going to talk to itself more. So typically, as things get bigger and have more loops, you'll see higher inductances. So you can now actually look at the problem and try to figure out the mutual inductance for the EMF induced in 2 due to 1, or the same thing where it is the EMF induced in 1 due to 2, the current changing in 2. And it turns out that because the relative geometry between these two is really the same, because it's actually the geometry of the two of them that comes into play when you evaluate the mutual inductance and their arrangement with respect to one another, it turns out that this is completely symmetric. So you may have a problem set up where it's easy to sort of figure out one direction of these and not the other, the induction is the same either way. It's the mutual inductance is basically this M is the same constant. So typically you don't worry about it. Typically in circuit problems, you just think of it as a self-inductance, and there'll be some inductance element that's in the circuit, and you just treat it as if that's the source of inductance, and it's sort of talking to itself, unless the problem is set up a different way. Yes?
So when you check this before with a change in current, did we ignore like self-inductance?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
When we did problems before with like a charging capacitor and the current that changes on the circuit, like with a differential equation, did we ignore the self-inductance that might occur there?
Yeah, earlier we've ignored it. And so now we're putting it in, and we're about to do problems with it, actually. And it brings in some really great... Sorry, I don't know why this is... It brings in some really great time-dependent issues, so we'll... Sorry, I don't know. Once we have the inductor, a nice thing about the picture of the inductor, a classic inductor is a solenoid. And the solenoids are nice because you get a uniform magnetic field. So knowing the geometry and figuring out what the energy is that's stored in the magnetic field, last time we found out that the energy density in a magnetic field goes as B squared over 2 mu, where this is a magnitude squared. And this is analogous to what we have for the electric field. And so these are general, and although we used very specific elements like capacitive parallel plates and a solenoid to derive these, the end result is really only in terms of the electric field and the magnetic field. So these are always true, and it doesn't really matter whether it's time dependent or not. If you want to know what the energy density is at that instant, that's what it is. And then we integrated this, well, we integrated the we used the EMF across an inductor and looked at it in terms of energy and found that the energy stored in an inductor goes as 1/2 Li squared, which you'll find is a pretty useful thing to know. Okay, maybe that helps. All right, so now that we have this different circuit element that has strange behavior, what I'd like to do is to look at what happens in circuits when we actually have such a thing in it. So where we've looked at RC circuits, I now want to look at an LR circuit. But first, let's do a demo. Okay. So... what we have is a big coil of wire hooked directly across an outlet, basically. And then there's a chunk of iron that goes all the way through. Okay? So we haven't yet talked about magnetic fields and materials, right? I think that's after we do AC circuits. All right, so what happens is with the iron, when you have a magnetic field in this coil, it will line up the iron atoms which have unpaired electrons, so that the spin of the iron, you actually get little current loops that effectively strengthen the field quite a bit. Okay, so that's the basis behind an electromagnet. You can have a certain current going in a current loop, and if you have a chunk of iron in it, you basically can get the unpaired spins of all the iron atoms joining and gives you a much stronger field for a relatively small current. So that's the power of the electromagnetic magnet. So what we've got is basically a magnetic field being generated in this coil. It turns out to be one that's flipping in sine back and forth at 60 hertz because of the way it's hooked up, but let's not worry about that right now because it's sort of irrelevant. Just think of it as a big magnetic field that goes from zero to big. And what we have are two loops that are identical, except one has a cut right here. So one is a continuous loop and one is not. All right? And let's say that I put the one that is not here so that if I turn this on, I'll get a big magnetic field coming on. What's going to happen to that loop? Will it?
Nothing.
Why?
Because it's not a closed loop.
Right. So you'll get an induced EMF, but your current actually cannot flow. So you're going to you're not going to get this counter rotating circuit in here. If we could see electromagnetic waves, we might see something, but we'll get to that. But in terms of the current in this, all right, I turned it on. I don't know if you can hear the hum, but nothing very exciting. Now I'm going to take the closed loop and put it on there and turn it on. Oops. So what happened?
The current's going this way.
So imagine you're going from zero to a huge current, right? So you'll get this huge magnetic field, and we'll just pick a direction, that's going from zero to up. Okay? If you're going from zero to up, what's happening in this loop? Right, so you're going from zero to up, so you're going to induce a current in this loop in such a direction that it will try to fight that field. So you're going to get an induced current going around the other this way to produce a field that fights the one that's coming in. So if you have two north poles going up against one another, what happens? That's why it jumps. Okay? Is that cool? All right. Now, we're going to do the same thing, but we're going to take that aluminum loop and we're going to cool it down to liquid nitrogen temperature. It's happily boiling away right now. What do you think is going to happen? Any, you going to hazard a guess?
The field will cancel out and they will stay put.
It's just aluminum, so it's not a superconductor. Well, if it were a superconductor, it'd be fun to do because I think you're right. Huh? Yeah. Most materials, the resistance drops. You know, even if they're not superconductors, it'll drop when you cool them down. The way I think about that is, when things are hot, you've got all this lattice motion, even if things are basically fixed, which effectively gives it a little bit more resistance. I mean, if you can think back to our electrons in love, right? If it's a huge crowd on the quad and everybody's just standing still and you then try to run, you sort of have an easier time running than it would be if everybody was sort of just moving back and forth randomly, right? Then you might have a much harder time fighting through. And I know that's a little bit hand-waving, but that's the picture that I use for it. But so let's see. What's going to happen if the resistance is less? You'll get more current, right? So it might be more exciting. Cool. All right. I had a friend whose undergraduate professor did something like this, but he did it with a little chunk of superconductor, and apparently it went through the ceiling. I don't know how true that is, but it was told as a true story. I haven't done it, although I ought to try. Just because we have a good tall ceiling. I think it was the smallest room. All right, so another thing that we can do, and unfortunately you can't really see the pieces of this, is one of the useful things to do with induction is you can take a loop that will have a certain magnetic field, and you know that if you put a current in there, you'll get a certain magnetic field. If you now have another loop that has many, many, many more turns, right, then for a given change in the current here, you'll get an induced voltage here that is much larger than what you started with. And this is basically the fundamental thing that makes transformers work. Step-up transformers, where you take a small voltage and create a large voltage. Or step down, you can use the same thing in reverse. So we actually have a step-up transformer here, and we're going to take wall power and drive a smallish loop and have a big loop connected across these two wires that come up like this. And I don't know how much pedagogy there is in this, but I like it. See, isn't that cool? I could sit here and just, that's just so cool. You'll smell some ozone in a bit. All right, so you get this huge voltage across these things, right? So you get this big electric field, and you'll get a breakdown, but it's hot, so it's rising because you have ions and everything that are... So is that cool? All right, I don't know. Looks like a science fiction movie to me, so... So next time you're watching Frankenstein, you can say, "Hey, I know how they do that." All right, LR circuits. So an LR circuit has a resistor and an inductor, which you use the symbol of a spring, or a solenoid, I guess. So we'll say that we have a big L, a big R, and an EMF. And if you have a circuit and you go around, at any given instant, you're going to have some of the voltages be zero. You go, well, but you have an induced EMF. But we're actually going to include that as what's happening in the inductor, right? If we don't worry about the induced EMF in this circuit, and what we're going to do is we're going to assume that all of the inductance is in this one circuit element, the little solenoid. If you don't think about the inductance, then it's just a loop of wire, so there's no EMF across it, right? So it is by saying there's an EMF across that we're taking into account the inductance. But once we take into account the inductance, then as you go around this loop, you have to come back to the same voltage that you start with. So Kirchhoff's law still sort of holds. So we're going to assume the sum of the voltages is equal to zero around the circuit at a fixed time. And so that means that the EMF across the battery minus the EMF induced, and you know that you induce an EMF in a direction that fights the EMF that's creating it, so it should come in with an opposite sign. And then we know that you lose, it takes energy to fight your way across the resistor. So there is the differential equation to start out with for this circuit. And just like we did earlier, rather than worry about solving this formally, we're just going to say what solution we have. So if we put in a solution where the current is equal to the EMF over the resistance times 1 minus e to the minus t r over l, if you were to take this solution and plop it into that equation, you'd find that it actually solves it. So just like we did last time, we're going to take the time dependence. It's all in this exponential. And because it's an exponential, we're going to take the stuff that multiplies it and call it a time constant. And you always do that with exponentially changing things, because basically it is that time constant that quantifies the speed with which this thing is dropping. So if you look at this, this exponential will drop to 1 over e in a time which is equal to this TL. This is called the time constant, which is equal to L over R. Yes?
What's that on the bottom? In the second one, the negative T over, is that tau?
That's a tau, yeah. That's a tau sub L. Tau sub L is defined as the inductive time constant. And that's going to be equal to L over R. It's got to be equal to the inverse of what you have multiplying time here, so that things drop by a factor of 1 over E when you have gone a time of one time constant. So if we look at the current as a function of time, then we're going to have a behavior where we start out at t equals 0. This term is 0. And we have I is equal to I is equal to 0. So when t is equal to 0, the exponential term is 1. And so we end up starting here. And then as we go up in time, this exponential term drops, which means this quantity grows exponentially, with asymptotically reaching this epsilon over r, because at very large time, this second term is 0. So we just have this the EMF over r. V is equal to IR, so that is the asymptotic value, as if we had no inductor in the system at all. So you're going to have an asymptotic value here, which is the EMF over R. And then the curve is going to look like this. So it looks a lot like a charging RC circuit, in fact. And if you have a small inductive time constant, it'll look like this. And if you have a large inductive time constant, it will charge slower, or the current will grow more slowly. And the current will grow to 1 over E of its final value in one time constant. So that's sort of what determines how this thing looks. So what I have here is a large inductor and a large resistance, and a power supply that's basically acting as the EMF. And this EMF is a square wave EMF, so it puts a voltage of a fixed value one direction across the circuit elements, and then it switches the other way, and then it does it like that. But it's a fixed value. So if I were to plot just that, that's the square wave. It's not the greatest square wave in the world, but in fact, I think probably inductor is causing a bit of an issue there. But that is the voltage that you see. So the next thing we're going to look at is what is the voltage across the inductor itself. This is the voltage that the EMF is putting out. And now what we want to do is ask what is the voltage across the inductor, or if you want to think about it, what is the voltage across the resistor, right? I guess that's a better way to think about it, although looks like he's measuring it across the inductor. Doesn't really matter. We're looking at it, going to look at it, think of it as voltage across the resistor, because that depends on the current. And we just looked here at how the current changes with time. So we should expect to see the voltage across the circuit elements, like the resistor, the current in the circuit should be changing with this sort of thing. So that means the voltage across the resistor should change in the same way. So if I now look at, I'm going to add to it, this curve is going to stay, so you see what's happening with the voltage at the EMF. And then I want to look at the voltage effectively across the resistor, or a measure of the current. And you can see if I inverted that. Almost looks like something's inverted.
With the camera.
Yeah. That may... Oh, yeah. Sorry, it makes sense here. Thank you. I'm sitting there. You need to think of time as actually going this way. Sorry. So, yeah. All right. And so now if I increase the resistance, you're going to increase the resistance, the time constant for the inductance, right, is going to get smaller if I increase the resistance. So I would expect a smaller time constant for this thing to change more sharply. So I'm going to now increase the resistance. And you see it rising and falling much more sharply. If I decrease the resistance, then it goes. You can see what's happening across the power supply too, that it's actually getting affected by what's happening with the current, with the circuit itself. It's sort of talking to itself. Anyway, so okay. So again, how the elements that you put inside the circuit actually can govern what's happening with the currents in the circuit. So this is part of the game people play with electric circuits. So that's the current. If we want to look at the voltage, which I guess we just sort of did, but the voltage goes as I times R, and we have I already in this equation, so if we multiply this by R, we end up with just the EMF here. These are pretty new batteries, so I don't know why this thing is giving me such a hard time. Or maybe they're not. Those are the old batteries that I thought I had replaced. All right, so V is equal to IR, so we multiply what we have for our EMF up here by R. We end up with the voltage across the inductor goes as the EMF times 1 minus E to the minus T over the inductive time constant. So we have the current, we have the voltage. So the next thing I'd like to do is to say that we go sometime t later. Usually that means after it's achieved its asymptotic value. So we're going to then short L across R. And what we mean by short is we just connect with a conductor directly across. So the circuit now, basically we're going to take the EMF out of the circuit. So we'll have a circuit that looks something like this, where we just have the resistor and the inductor, and now we play the same game. But as we go around, 0 is equal to IR plus LDI over DT. So that I is equal to E over R, E to the minus T over TL. This one's much simpler to measure or to solve. But it's very similar to what we had for the discharging capacitor, where we were looking at charge, now we're looking at current. It's the same form. So if we now plot the current across in the circuit as a function of time, it's going to start out at the asymptotic value, epsilon over R, and it's going to drop exponentially, where that dropping is governed by the inductive time constant. And then again, if you have a large TL, tau L, it will drop more slowly, and if you have a small one, it drops faster. You okay with this? Yes?
How does the epsilon still run in the solution?
Yeah, I think it's just the initial condition.
Oh, right.
All right, so that was sort of boring. Let's do one that's a little bit more fun. Let's look at something which involves a capacitor. If the capacitor is empty and you just hook it across an inductor, nothing's going to happen, right? You have no EMF in it. So this gets fun if you actually have a fully charged capacitor. And you toss it into a circuit that has an inductance, right? And then you just let it go. And we're going to assume that this is a basically resistance-free circuit for right now. And in order to analyze this, the best thing to do is not really think of Kirchhoff's laws, but what I'd like to do is to look at energy in the system. Let's imagine that we have, and you might not do that, you know, if you were just sitting down for the first time ever and looking at this, it might not be your first step, but people have thought about it, and I know that I'd like to think about it in terms of energy because that will get us where we want to go. So if we look at the energy in this circuit, you can think of that as the energy that is stored in this piece and the energy that is stored in that piece separately. The energy that is stored in the capacitor is going to be in the electric field between the plates. The energy that's stored in the inductor is going to be in the magnetic field. That's sort of the picture that we have for each of these things. So I will say that this is the energy in the electric field plus the energy in the magnetic field. And in a capacitor, the energy that's in it is 1/2 CV², which is also equal to 1/2 times Q squared over C. Let me use a small case Q. So if we want to think about how much energy is stored in the capacitor, it depends on how much charge is on the capacitor at that moment. And these are two ways of writing it. The energy in the magnetic field in the inductor we know goes as 1/2 Li². So this whole thing, the equation becomes Q squared over 2C plus Li² over 2. You okay with that? Now, we could have energy changing here. We could ask, how does this change with time? In this circuit, there is no resistance. So in that limit, there's no loss in energy in the circuit as a whole. So if I ask, what is the power dissipation in the circuit? If I ask, how does this energy change with time? It's going to be zero, because we're going to have to conserve energy. If I put a resistor in there, that's not true, right? Because you're going to dissipate energy in the resistor. So that's going to be equal to the change in energy in the electric field density and the change plus the change in energy density in the magnetic field. Or we can take the derivative of each of these pieces with respect to time. So this is going to be 2q over 2c times the change in Q with respect to time plus L over 2i times dI over dt. And remember that this current is dQ over dt and this is dQ over dt. Because these terms are equal to zero, this current and that current cancel with each other, so those just fall out. So I end up with an equation that is zero is equal to L dI over dt plus Q over C. If we rewrite current in terms of charge, What does that look like? Yeah, so this is simple harmonic motion. And again, my trick to remember that is, I always remember the spring, so F is equal to minus KX, F is M times the second time derivative of the position, plus KX is equal to zero. Pull the M down, and this gives you a solution that goes as a harmonic sine omega T, and omega is equal to plus or minus the square root of K over M. Yeah. So that's the piece I remember. And if you look at this, you've got the second derivative of charge with respect to time and a linear charge, so that's basically the same form. And once you realize this is simple harmonic motion, it has a frequency which is 1 over the square root of LC. So this is simple harmonic motion in charge with respect to time. So we can write a harmonic solution for the charge. Q of T, if we do it generally, we'll say that's equal to some maximum value of the charge times a cosine of omega T plus phi. In this case, you have to pull out your special decoder ring. This phi has nothing to do with flux. This is just a phase angle so that you have a general solution. And omega is equal to 1 over the square root of LC. Or omega squared goes as, I guess it's better to say omega squared is equal to 1 over LC. If we take the time derivative of this, we find that the current as a function of time is dq of t over dt, which is going to be minus omega q times the sine of omega t plus phi. You all right? So given this, what I'd now like to do is to look at the energy flow. And we already have, we sort of have a feeling for the energy flow here. So let's go back and look at the energy flow. We know what the energy in the electric field looks like. In the capacitor, the energy stored in the electric field goes as Q squared over 2C. And we now have a solution for Q as a function of time. So this will look like big Q squared over 2C times cosine squared of omega T plus phi. Similarly, I'd like to look at the B term. This is the energy stored in the solenoidal piece, or the inductor, as a function of time. And this goes as 1 half L I squared. And we've solved for I already up here. So this is equal to L over 2 times Q squared omega squared times sine squared omega T plus phi. All right, so here we have the energy stored in B or in the inductor as a function of time. So look at this. These are both squared harmonic terms, right? So you're going to go between zero and these quantities. And you're going to have a time dependence, which I did not write correctly on that bottom. This is omega t plus phi. You have a time dependence that just goes as the square of these harmonic functions, but one goes as cosine and one goes as sine, and so they're out of phase by one period. So what you'll end up with, if you plot these two things as a function of time, you'll get something like that. Right, omega goes as 1 over LC. Omega squared is equal to 1 over LC. So if we look at this piece, we have LQ squared over 2. Omega squared goes as 1 over LC, so we get the L's cancel, and we end up with Q squared over 2C here being the maximal value for the magnetic field energy, just like we have for the electric field. So that basically means you have, as a function of time, the energy starting out completely in the capacitor, because that's how we started, with all the charge in the capacitor. So there's no magnetic field happening in the inductor, okay? Not yet. Nothing's going on. We have the charge across the capacitor. It's now shorted through the inductor. That's all a conductor, right? So the charge from the capacitor begins to discharge and begins to flow. As that happens, you get a current in the inductor, which means that you get a magnetic field starting in the inductor. So that means once you get a magnetic field starting in the inductor, the energy is beginning to flow into the inductor. So as the energy drops in the capacitor, because the charge is leaving, the electric field is reduced, the energy in the capacitor begins to drop, and at the same time, the energy in the inductor begins to rise until you reach the point where you have maximal current change, which is going to give you maximal magnetic field in the inductor. And at that point, you actually have no charge in the capacitor, so you end up with zero energy. So you have the energy flowing from one circuit element to another, and in the limit of having a resistanceless circuit, this just goes on with a very characteristic frequency, which depends on what your inductance and your capacitance are. So you have this kind of picture happening. These are known as LC oscillations. All right, so this is where we start. We have a charged capacitor. All the electric field is sitting here. There's no magnetic field in the inductor. And then as a function of time, current begins to flow. We begin to develop a magnetic field here in the inductor. But the field on the electric field is being reduced. You reach a point where you have no electric field in the capacitor, but at that point you actually have maximal magnetic field in the inductor because they're completely out of phase, and then the energy flows back because as the charge begins to flow on because of the induced current, you end up going the other way and you get full field strength here, and then you go through another cycle the other way. So the current just flows one way and then the other. And the frequency with which this happens is dependent on what you choose here for your capacitance and your inductance. You all right with that? minute you get this kind of oscillation, all of a sudden you are, you have potential to get a resonant situation, right? Whenever you have something oscillating like a swing set, I mean, you know, some kid in a swing, and every time the kid's back here, you give them a little bit of energy, then you get forced oscillations, and you can get a resonant situation, and you can get an enhancement of the signal strength. That's sort of where we're headed now. You can imagine that you now have, in every circuit, it will have some capacitance and some inductance. And that means it's going to have a natural oscillation frequency. Just like in mechanics, things have a natural vibrational frequency. And so this now is the basis for things like selecting radio frequencies and things like that. There was a question?
Why is there no energy stored in the electric field of the inductor?
There is no electric field in the inductor. There's just current. So it creates this magnetic field, but it has no electric field in there. This is in the limit of, we're not thinking about it radiating away any of its energy by inducing an electric field, because you have a changing magnetic field, inducing an electric field in the space around it, which it actually could do. It will actually radiate away some of its energy in the form depending on what the frequency is, in the form of some form of electromagnetic radiation, which we'll get to, but we're ignoring that. All right, I don't know if you've noticed, and I don't know that you will all think it's a good thing. For most of my lectures, I don't even look at your textbook, and I actually do that deliberately. I do try to choose notation sometimes that matches, although I'm sure I don't do that all the time. My feeling is your textbook is a reasonable, readable one, and I want it there for your reference, but I actually deliberately try to develop lectures not necessarily using the textbook you've got, because I want you to see it in different ways. Sometimes the way I present it and the way the textbook presents it may be a little bit different, so I'm sorry if sometimes that's confusing, but I opt to do it so that you actually see it two different ways. And so normally I just, when I'm developing lectures or whatever, I just completely ignore the textbook and the course itself while I'm doing it. Although I try to stay coherent and at least keep you in the right chapters of the text. Now I'm about to do it exactly the opposite way, because I really like the way Ohanian does AC circuits, which is where we're headed next. So you will actually find this treated very nicely in Ohanian, and I don't know whether to... You should breathe a sigh of relief that finally I'm doing something like the textbook, or whether I should apologize for actually just basically taking this out of your textbook. But I looked in a pile of different textbooks in a way to introduce AC circuits, and I really like what Ohanian does. So, AC. We've been looking at direct current circuits, DC, where the EMF basically stays fixed in the circuit, both in direction and in magnitude. And now what I'd like to do is to go to alternating current circuits. And we're going to symbolize the EMF by this kind of symbol. Because what's happening is that it's going to change with a fixed frequency its direction. So first we're going to look at an alternating EMF across a resistance. So when we say it's an AC circuit, what I really mean is that the EMF is equal to some maximal value times the sine of omega t, where omega is basically a frequency of the, which is, you can think of this, a standard way to make an AC thing is to have a loop of wire and you have a magnetic field and you just spin the loop. And now, as you can imagine, it's going to induce me in EMF that's going to go one way and then the other way as the loop goes around. So if we look at, if we basically take Kirchhoff's law, the way we've been doing it, EMF minus the current in the circuit times the resistance is equal to zero. So the current is equal to the EMF divided by the resistance. So the current is going to go as Emax times the sine of omega t divided by R. If we think about what the power is going to be, so instantaneous power dissipation, the power goes as I times V, which is going to be I times the EMF. It's going to be E max squared over R times the sine squared of omega t. So now we have the sine squared term, and this is instantaneous power dissipation. Typically, when you talk about power, what's really important is what happens over a certain amount of time. So if we want to think about this through at least one period, the time average of sine squared which I'm going to signify with this bar over it is just equal to 1/2. So what happens is that we have Emax squared over R as a function of time. Emax squared over R is going to be the maximum amplitude of the power dissipation. And this thing is going to go as a sine, which means it starts out zero, but it's going to look as a sine square curve. So it's going to oscillate between zero and this maximum value, where this is pi over omega, and this is 2 pi over omega, etc. So you're going to get power dissipation, which is actually going to be time dependent. And then if you want to integrate over a certain amount of time, then the sine squared becomes 1/2. So the time averaged power, which is what's really important if you're going to boil water or something, have any questions on any of this so far? All right, so we're just getting into some pretty interesting stuff, actually. But I need to now look at what happens to a capacitor by itself in an alternating current circuit, what happens to an inductor by itself in an alternating current circuit, and then we'll combine them into something. And at that point, you begin to see some pretty fun stuff that ties in with the LC oscillations. So, okay. All right. Have a good day.